Good morning and welcome. It's so lovely to see you all today, and welcome to our Zoom friends. I'm Winnie Gordon, Minister at Birmingham Unitarians and tutor at Unitarian College. I'm black, female, with black blonde locks, wearing an orange top and a multicolour trousers. And with me today is...
I'm Sarah Tinker. Hello, everybody. I'm white, I'm female, mousy hair still, brightly patterned top, now a retired minister, keeping myself busy, and delighted to be here with you all. Hopefully, if you're here in person today, you'll have found an order of service. We're starting our theme talk with a story for all ages. There'll be three places later where you can join in singing. And Winnie and I are going to be doing our talks in two sections each, so you'll get us four times. There'll be some wriggle breaks, and do feel free to move around if you want to at any time. And what a good idea I've just come up with. Let's all make sure our phones are on silent, including mine. Yes.
There we go.
So in the olden days, when I was young, and actually even longer ago than that, though that is hard to imagine, a time so very, very long ago. But in those olden days, there weren't shops like Primark or Marks and Spencers selling clothes, not even charity shops selling the clothes that other people no longer wanted. Every bit of clothing, just think it through, every bit of clothing had to be made from hand, by hand, from fabric. Someone had to weave that fabric by hand from cotton or wool or hemp, and then make a pattern and cut out the cloth, sew it all together with a needle to make the clothes. And this is a story about a woman who earned her living making clothes for other people, a seamstress known as Martina, lived in the poorest part of a small town. She'd lost her much-loved husband and her children to the plague some years earlier. Her life was tough and sometimes lonely. But Martina, she had a good heart and she cared about others. And people in the town loved her and they brought her work whenever they could afford to. Not that many people could afford to have new clothes in those days, but Martine was a great mender of holes and tears, so she got by. She knew that many people were in a worse state than her. So one Christmas Eve, she couldn't afford to light the stove, but she pulled up close to it anyway. She lit a candle and cuddled up in her old favourite blanket, and she drifted off to sleep with the sounds of children singing carols in the streets. And as she slept, she heard a voice speaking to her. Martina, the voice said, as if someone had breathed the word above her ear. She jumped from her sleep. Who's there? She asked. She turned around, she looked at the door, no one was there, but she heard that voice again, quite clearly. Martina, Martina, pay attention tomorrow, for I shall come visiting. She roused herself. She got up from her chair. She rubbed her eyes. She didn't know who'd spoken. And she wondered if her first thought could actually be true, that it was God who had spoken to her just now. Was God really going to visit? And on Christmas Day? So Martina did what lots of us do when we think a guest is coming to our place. She started a full-on cleaning session. Because suddenly we feel a bit ashamed, don't we, of those odd cobwebs, that dust, that vase of dead flowers on the table. She swept, she polished, and she decided to use what little bit of coal she'd got to light the stove and bake some heart-shaped biscuits. And though she had nothing much to give this very important guest that might be calling round tomorrow, she found a piece of softest lambskin and she started to sew the softest pair of slippers you could possibly imagine as a gift for her guest. And she slept so well that night, she was woken in the morning to hear a quiet knocking. At her door, and she rushed to welcome the special guest in. But, you know, it was only her next-door neighbour come to wish her happy Christmas. He was an old soldier who had no money, very poor health. So she made him a cup of tea, and she knew she would have to give him some of those special heart-shaped biscuits. He was shaking with the cold, and so as he left, she pressed her old favourite blanket into his hands. No sign of God yet. But before long, Martina spotted some local children out of the window, and she knew their mum was on her own and that the family didn't have two pennies to rub together, nor two sticks to rub together to start a fire. So Martina went out, she gave them the rest of the biscuits and a bag of kindling wood for their fire. "Are you sure?" cried the mother. "Why don't you keep the biscuits?" "Well, I was saving them for a special guest, but I know they won't mind. I still have another gift." Now, Martina felt actually a little bit sad that God hadn't called round yet. She busied herself in finishing those soft slippers and making a beautiful job of them. La la! Evening fell, and she knew that nobody would come calling at this time of night. She heard the church bells chime midnight, and then a loud coughing sound coming from out of the street. She saw a local man who had nowhere to live settling down for the night in a church doorway across the way. She knew how badly he suffered with his chilblained feet and his bad chest, so she made another cup of warm tea and she took it out to him. And she took the slippers too, for she guessed that his old boots would be leaking. The snow was starting to melt. He thanked her and he said that she'd made this his best Christmas in many a long year. So then Martina tiptoed back to her little shop and home. She sat in her comfortable chair. She closed her eyes. And as she dozed, she heard that same voice that she'd heard the night before. "Thank you, kind seamstress. I visited you yesterday and you gave me a warming blanket and a cup of tea. I was hungry and you gave me heart-shaped biscuits. And dear, kind Martina, I was homeless in the snowy street and you came to visit me. Thank you for giving me the finest pair of your slippers. Whatever you did for all these people, you also did for me." And her heart felt very glad indeed when she heard that voice again. And maybe God did come to visit Martina the seamstress all those years ago. Maybe God can be found wherever love is shown. And somewhere I have got just a few more heart-shaped biscuits for the children's group to take with them. Farewell, my loves. Farewell. Oh, you have to say goodbye to you. See her later. Thank you. So we're going to sing now. If you have a look at your order of service, you'll see a chant which is from something called the Chalice Meditations Project. You can get these chants with music and sound files online. They're completely free to use, and it's a really nice way to just bring something a bit different to one of your services, perhaps. But we're learning this from scratch, so we'll be gentle, won't we?
We will. Yeah. I was told all this at 10 o'clock last night. But I was told, you've got 1 minute to teach it to them. So, bearing that in mind, this side, I want you to do the first four lines. Life of the Spirit is shining in you. The life of the Spirit is shining in me. The life of the Spirit is shining within. How blessed we must be. Okay, it goes like this. After four. One, two, three, four.
The light of the Spirit is shining in you. The light of the Spirit is shining in me. The light of the Spirit is shining within. How
coming.
Higher.
Well, if we could do higher.
The light is shining. Have a blessed Christmassy.
So this side starts, and then Sarah will lead on the second side over there. Here we go. I'll do a little introduction.
I think there are another seven of those chants. Who wrote the words? Oh, I've been forced to say that I wrote the words. There aren't many words there, are there? But just as importantly, David Kent wrote the music. And you can find all of these on his website. Lovely. Oh, it's me, actually, isn't it? Yeah, I was waiting. It's all got too exciting. That story we just heard of Martina the seamstress and her acts of love towards others is based on a Leo Tolstoy story written in 1885 called Where Love Is, God Is. And that combining of God and love pretty much sums up what I'd say if I'm asked that old chestnut of a question. Do you believe in God? Now, it's a question I've been asked a fair bit over the years, but actually not so much as a minister, but as a secondary school teacher of religious education. And it's a question I've been thinking myself from my earliest years, because if there is such a thing as a religious gene, then I was born with it. Not that I had a religion as a youngster, not consciously anyway, nor did I come from a religious family. But in a 1950s English childhood, we stood up straight and we sang two Christian hymns each and every morning in school assemblies. I loved it. We had a religious education lesson each and every week. If you joined the brownies and guides, you really did have to turn up for church parade and perish the thought that you might turn up without polished shoes and your neckerchief straight. Yes, I have been scarred by fierce looks from a brown owl. And many younger people cannot believe this, but in the olden days, if you went to the cinema when I was a child, we'd stand up as they played the national anthem at the end of each performance. God save the Queen, da 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 da. And as children, we knew our Bible stories, or at least the stories that were retold for us by Lady Bird Books, with all the characters looking like nice white English people, but wearing desert robes. Very exciting. I can look back at all of that and see it as cultural religion, that we absorbed all that was around us in society. But what I'd now describe as my own religious and spiritual impulses, they were bubbling away within me. And I wonder if this chimes with any of you. It's interesting to talk about. As a young child, I did a lot of thinking and watching and wondering. I cared deeply about how animals and people were treated in that order. I could see how unfair this world was. I have a younger sister, Mandy, who has disabilities, and some of you have met her here at summer school. And I wondered why she had to suffer all that pain rather than me. I was deeply interested in starry skies and how big the sky was and what the moon was doing. I'm with you, Louise, on that one. And then that big question, how did all this happen? If Adam and Eve and that apple were just part of a story, then where did we all come from? So with all those kinds of thoughts buzzing around in my head, it's no surprise, is it, that I chose religious studies at O level and A level, taught, luckily, I think, by several really inspiring teachers. Then I studied, amongst other things, the sociology of religion at university. I went on to be an RE teacher. But in all that time of religious exploration, I never joined a church or any other religious organisation. Yet my own private religious life was there inside, just occasionally being brought into everyday life in conversations with certain friends. I was deeply interested, but watching from the sidelines. I was observing, perhaps, rather than taking part, and certainly not joining any group of believers. And I could put that down, perhaps, to a shared attitude with the comedian Groucho Marx, who famously said, I refuse to join any club that would have me as a member. But then, in 1991, life took a turn, and I knew I needed a community in which to belong. We'd become parents to two amazing children who came to us aged 5 and 6, having had more life experiences than us in those few years. They were full of energy, and I knew we needed a village to help raise them, a ready-made community that would take us in. And I put my head nervously round the door at Fulwood Old Chapel, which happened to be just round the corner from the house we'd just moved into, and life took another of those turns. The Unitarians in that chapel, particularly at that time, could run courses on how to welcome people in. Jean and Gavin Mason, Graham and Sue Toulson, to mention a few names that a couple of people here might remember. And what do I remember about their welcome? It was warm, it was inclusive, they were interested in me and my new family, that does help, and they offered a bit of help. Would we like to take the kids round to play with Gavin's model railway or come to a bonfire party? Oh, yes, please. And before long, someone had asked me to do a reading for a service and I was smitten. Soon taking services and joy of joy, running the children's group. The services there were quirkily varied. There was no one fixed set of beliefs that all Unitarians had to sign up to. And though the congregation didn't have a minister of their own, we were visited regularly by a minister called Trevor Jones, a complex, sometimes troubled man, but also hugely appealing. He played the guitar, he led us in raucous community singing, funny games for the children. His service style was innovative, he made you think. And best of all for me, he'd offer a small group course where we might meet, say, for 6 Thursday evenings in a row and get to talk about our beliefs and what mattered to us. I'm still involved with Fulwood Old Chapel all these years later, and I still lead occasional services there. And only last month, somebody was reminiscing about one of those courses that Trevor ran for us, called BYOT. Building Your Own Theology. And this man at the chapel was saying how much this course had meant to him, and I agreed. It really was life-changing stuff, although it's quite old-fashioned now when I look at it, of course. And I've always remembered when it was Trevor's turn to describe what God meant to him. As 10 of us sat in a circle together, and with a wry smile, he said, "Well, it all depends what you mean by God." Now that's one apparently for the Unitarian bingo card, Louise told us in her epilogue last night. I went home full of the thought that a minister might not have to believe in God in the sky, not have to believe in a God that answers your prayers if he likes you. Full of the thought that God as a concept could be way beyond a world of just two genders. Thrilled to have spent an evening with like-hearted people talking about what the divine meant to us. In that small group that evening, we'd drawn pictures, we'd played with words in poetry, we'd had silence and music and laughter and a few tears. And I'd found my first religious community, age 36. And little did I know how many life-changing experiences lay ahead. So I wonder where you were in the summer of 1995. It's just... I can't get anybody dare shout out. Who?
Heavily
where?
Pregnant.
Heavily pregnant.
I was starting education again. My youngest was 4 and a half, so I was starting my master's degree.
Starting a degree. Yeah.
That was a mess.
I've heard a. Not born from this corner.
Using my GCSEs.
Oh.
Married a doctor.
Oh. That's lovely. So we were all at some stage or another in our lives, weren't we? In our life journey. I was here in Great Hucklow, as you've already heard, at the very first religious education summer school, as it was then called. None of us who were attending that event could have imagined it would still be taking place now in 2025. Now, I'd been to the Nightingale Centre already, bringing my children to junior weekends, but that summer school was a treat just for me. Looking back now, it was a feast of nostalgia. And I've left them upstairs, but I found the address lists for the first three summer schools of all the people attending. I both smiled and wept when I found those, reading those names. Some long gone, some long loved, some names I can't now put a face to. And I can't remember now much of what we spoke about. I can remember a little bit of what we did. And the most vivid memories, which shows another social change, these vivid memories of how much smoking and drinking went on in those days compared with today. We took over a room at the Queen Anne pub down the road on several evenings. We deafened other drinkers with our raucous singing. Astonishing to think back. So I've spent most of this first section not fully answering the brief for our talks, finding our religion, how to be religious in the 21st century. I've told you how religion found me, and I've told you about my version of being religious in the last century, really, rather than this one. And here we are, we're a quarter of a century already into the 21st century. And if it hadn't been obvious before, I'm sure it was, the 21st century certainly underlines a key point about religion, doesn't it? That there are lots of different versions. There are lots of different religions, there are different religious paths, and they can be both divisive and beautifully bringing people together. And of course, religions do tend to bring certain sorts of people together and exclude others. Of course, that's the nature of any human grouping, isn't it? It forms its identity by clarifying who is in the in-group and who is not. And we Unitarians and Free Christians, we're as much a part of that including and excluding process, however welcoming we try to be. But let's go beyond those kinds of dualities of in and out for a while and think, what are the human issues that religions seek to understand and explore and even sometimes give some definitive answers on? The timeless life questions that religions have addressed throughout the ages. Because I reckon that many of you will have been thinking about these issues at points in your lives. So here's a whistle-stop tour of a few of the matters that come to mind for me. And of course, we have to start with the big one, don't we? Death. We humans know that we die. But we don't know if various religious beliefs about death might be true. Then there's suffering, and how we manage and try to make sense of life's inevitable tragedies. We feel an urge to mark life's key transitions of birth, reaching adulthood, forming a partnership, death. And then there's injustice, the innate unfairness of life itself. These physical bodies, the social circumstances we're born into, but also the innate unfairness of economic and social systems in which we live. How do we use the strength of our communities to bring greater justice to our world? And peace, that yearning that most of us know, that yearning for harmony in both world affairs and what goes on in our own relationships and our neighbourhoods and our own hearts. Why is peace so very transitory for us humans? And how can we live ethically with our own and our shared moralities? And how do we function as healthy human communities with all the complexities of our relating together with one another? Now, Winnie is going to consider the vital and specific issues we face in the 21st century. I'm way out of my depth, I'll tell you. I'm eager to hand over to the next generation. So Winnie will be with us in a few minutes. But what I'm going to suggest now is we have a tiny stretch break, but I'm going to ask you to talk to somebody near you. So we just have 3 minutes for this and try and make sure that both of you get a chance. I'd ask you to tell the story of how you felt welcomed into a Unitarian or another community that's important to you. And I'm going to make the suggestion that if that was a positive experience, well, say the names, say where you were. If it was a negative one, that first encounter, well, don't advertise where you were, because it might just have been a bad day for them. You never know. So have a stretch, find somebody to talk to for about 3 minutes. Oh.
Of the Spirit is shining in you. The light of the Spirit is shining in me. The light of the Spirit is shining within. How blessed we must be.
Thank you. Sounds like very good conversations going on. And now please do continue it in our coffee time. When I think about what it means to be progressive people of faith, I'm inspired by wisdom of Douglas Taylor from the Unitarian Universalist Institute. His insights into our Unitarian theology speaks to the head and the heart. He invites us to engage in theological literacy, but to see our religion as a living, growing practice, something that guides us, challenges us, and calls us forward together. That's the Unitarianism of my dream. And as Tina said earlier, a place that offers sanctuary and provocation. So although I am going to attempt to reclaim our theological literacy for the beginning of my talk, for me, theological literacy is not what drew me to this faith. What attracted me to Unitarianism was not an intellectual theological framework, but a lived history of values and actions embedded in our tradition. The way Unitarians responded to the social and political upheavals of their times. Something I feel we need to go back to. I was drawn to the moment where our values met the challenges of history. Times when we lived our theology of love and interconnectedness. Times when we impacted lives. For instance, valuing learning as a way of lifting people out of poverty, therefore providing education for the poor, boys and girls, when it was rare. Taking a principled stance on human dignity in the abolitionist campaigns. Championing women's suffrage as an expression of the equal worth of every person. Keeping church membership doctrine free. Performing same-sex blessings when homosexuality in public was still criminalized. All these actions were examples of Unitarian theology of love. Now, although it wasn't explicitly stated early in our story, Martina's theology of love and her theology of human nature was evident in the values she lived. She centered love and compassion as she met each moment and each person's needs, providing food, a blanket, a pair of slippers that she'd made for another person. Let's look at a slide. I'm going to show you a slide that frames how Christianity frames the world around us, their understanding of those theological benchmarks. Right. Ecclesiology, meaning how we do church, our structures. Epistemology, which simply means where religion finds its religious authority. Cosmology, meaning the nature of the universe. How do we think about how we began? This is the word I hate because I can't say it very well. Eschatology, referring to the idea of the last days, the final destination. And the theology of human nature, that explores what it means to be human. And these are terms that I'm going to talk to you about in this half of my talk. Thank you, Ned. You can bring it back down now. What I want to say in particular is Unitarians are often accused of lacking these benchmarks, lacking depth. But I don't agree. And I'm going to prove it to you. Unitarianism is a challenging faith. We have no creed, and our beliefs are not our central unifying point. But we do have these theological benchmarks. Historically, we have wrestled, and still do, with the nature of the cosmos and of human beings, where we find our religious authority, which is many sources for us, how we define mission, why bad things happen, the idea of salvation, well, for us by good deeds, the awe and the mystery of life, both a revelation and an evolution. We attract people because of our lack of false doctrine and our diversity of beliefs. But it is how we are in relationship, as Rob reminded us, relationship with each other, practicing our values, that is at the core of our identity. It is our unifying values and how we live them out in the world. That is what most affirms who we are more than any theological language. We are, or should be, a faith community shaped by the transformative power of intentionality, or intentionally living our values in ways that benefit society. Being progressive, if we wish to claim that title, means being countercultural in situations where people are being dehumanized, excluded, or treated with inequality, especially regarding their identity and their well-being and their dignity and worth, as we heard from Andy on Saturday. So that is where I'm coming from. The belief that upholding our religion should be a value-based action faith if it is to meet the moments in the 21st century. I'm going to go back to our theological terms, those benchmarks, to emphasise that we do have a developed theological literacy on par with other religious traditions. So our ecclesiology, the ecclesiology meaning the structure and the nature of how we do church, we inherited it from our Presbyterians and Congregationalist roots, and embody in our democratic values and our leadership styles. Emma described an intergenerational team in her talk, an example of a structure that supports and guides one another. Our structures are unifying, are our unifying values and are enshrined in our constitution. So you have the constitution in front of you, right? That's the General Assembly Constitution. And we're going to go back to this again later on. So I'm just going to read the first part to you. We, the constituent congregations, affirm, calm down, affiliated societies and individual members, those are our structures. That's how we do, right? United in the spirit of mutual sympathy, cooperation, tolerance and respect, and recognising the worth and dignity of all people and their freedom to believe in their conscience dictates, as their conscience dictates. Right? All of that is expressing how we want to do church. Okay? We'll go back to that later. Our theological plurality is just that. A collection of beliefs that we hold, affirming our liberal heritage of holding no tradition as the only truth. The principle of trusting each other to form our own beliefs and non-beliefs affirms the values of Unitarianism as a place for seeking, exploring, learning, and supporting each other. Our epistemology, the source of our authority, often clashes with traditional religions whose source is a scripture, marking us as different. But our values of diversity and respect for differences must be unapologetically protected, because it has formed our religious community from the beginning and allowed us to live well even amongst tensions or polarizations. We have often punched above our weight in living out our values of equality, justice and equity, influencing social change locally and beyond, Our strength, as always, lay in coalescing around values, creating spaces for people to freely roam and explore. And as Judith found in her community, and opportunities to join together to inspire wider change. Be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies. Be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies. Words of Mother Teresa. And it was those small things, challenging prevalent biblical interpretation, that leading to the value of freedom of belief, falling away from a Trinitarian viewpoint, which led to our separation from the Church of England, and creating meeting houses and building our own congregations. Exploring Eastern religions, which seeded the idea of the inherent worth of all scriptures and all people, affirming the values of dignity for all. Religious oppression united us. Cooperation liberated us. And in the process, we recognized that the meaning of our lives is interdependent with each other. So as we turn to the question of what it means to be religious in the 21st century, I focus not on the plurality of our beliefs, but on what our beliefs, be it God, mystery, or science, individually and collectively, calls us to affirm through what Mel said yesterday, the values we live out in the world, doing what we can do. And this is what brought me here, and what keeps me here. A religion that is value-based and action-orientated, that aspires to meet the moments in the 21st century. A faith that transforms both itself and the world, not only through what we believe, but through how we live. Okay, that's a lot. So I'm going to ask you to turn to your handouts, which again is the General Assembly Constitution. To that statement that we as members of the General Assembly, because we are the members, are signed up to. You know, it illustrates our developed theological literacy, our epistemology, our cosmology, our ecclesiology, and our eschatology. It's all in there. And I invite you to take a moment to read it all through, and then I want you to talk to the person next to you and underline or circle anything that you think speaks to our theologies. And by this, I mean anything that speaks to our capacity to be good and what it means to be human. Anything that speaks to our understanding of the universe and what it means to be together and what our source of authorities are. There's quite a lot in that document. Now, I'll give you a minute to read it through and then a couple of minutes to just talk in pairs and underline anything that you find that speaks to us of our values and our theology. And my friends on Zoom, we're going to put the Constitution up on the screen, and please do work along with us, and I'll give you the answers afterwards. So please do. Please talk together and underline. Just a few minutes. You're quite quiet. You could talk to each other about it. Yeah, I said do. Yeah, do talk to each other.
Still reading it.
Oh, okay. Five.
Thank you.
One more minute. Thank you.
Too much to talk about.
It's a lot. Yeah. I've done my EC job. I've got you reading the Constitution. So, what are the examples of our theology of human nature in this document? What does it mean to be human? So that everyone has inherent dignity at the core, and we recognise the worth and dignity of all people. So I hope you underlined that. Freedom to believe. Right? And that to be a good human means to live in a state where the mind and the conscience are free. Right? So that's part of our theology of the human nature. What about cosmology? Meaning, what is our understanding of the universe? Did you underline respect for all creation? Mm-hmm. Worship of God? Mm-hmm. Celebration of life? Yeah? All of that speaks to our understanding of the interdependent web of all existence. Epistemology. Where do we find the source of our authority? Now, we have lots of sources of authority. So I hope you underlined the liberal Christian tradition, a liberal religious heritage, which doesn't mean necessarily Christian. As we go on to say, and you can underline this one as well, learn from the spiritual, cultural, and intellectual insights of all humanity. So we are wide breadth in our sources of authority. And, importantly, where the mind and conscience dictates. So the source of authority also rests in each of us.
Can I just ask what do you mean by the source of authority?
The documents or the thing that you use to draw your beliefs from.
Not God.
Well, for the Christian tradition, the Bible is the scripture that's the word of God, right? So we take it from the Bible, right? Ecclesiology, how we are to be together. And I hope here you underlined a spirit of mutual sympathy. That's how we want to be together, right? In cooperation, in tolerance, in respect. Also promoting free and inquiring religion. That's how we want to be together. Upholding our religious liberty of members. Unconstrained by the imposition of creeds. That's another important part of how we want to be together. This is how we govern and covenant to be. Eschatology. What do we see as the end days, the final destination, kind of? How we want the world to reveal itself. As Unitarians, we don't focus on the next life because we want it all in this life, the here and now. So for us, our end days see a world where the service of humanity and the respect for all creation is paramount. If all of us in the whole world was about the service of humanity and the respect for all creation, we wouldn't have a problem with climate change. Right? We wouldn't have a problem with each other. There would be love, there wouldn't be hate, there wouldn't be prejudice and all that. So that is the proverbial kingdom of heaven for us. So we could take down the constitution for the Zoom people now. Thank you, Jane. We are sometimes accused of being just a club for like-minded people. Yet our theologies are a deeply considered, rooted in values that shape how we aspire to live. It calls us to mutual sympathy and to stand with those affected by war and displacement, to secure freedoms for the marginalised and equality for all genders, to wonder at the universe and to honour life's milestones. Free from imposed creeds, we keep seeking truth, drawing wisdom from all humanity and letting conscience drive us to action. For me, being religious is not about what you believe, but by how you live out those values that unify us as a faith community, how we embody our identity in the world. So, as Sarah comes up, let's have a shuffle break. And Sarah's going to talk. Yes.
Let's get those bodies moving, everybody. Have a stretch and a wriggle.
Take your time, settle down. Thank you. So I said that I'd first met the Unitarians back in 1990, but you know, I'd actually noticed a Unitarian chapel a decade earlier, in a shared house with friends, again, just round the corner from another Unitarian chapel, Unity Chapel, near Sheffield University, now a University Hall of Residence, that building. Then a big red brick place, quite a forbidding, yet kind of beautiful looking place of worship. Now, the few people I saw walking in there on a Sunday, they looked a fair bit older than all of us, and probably at that moment, there was nothing that could have encouraged me through their doors, maybe a yoga class if they'd been running one. And yet, you know, I was intrigued by them because they displayed the posters known as wayside pulpits that had quotes on them that made me think. Do you know, there was never one that I disagreed with or disliked. And my favourite of all time was shown more than once at Unity Chapel. "We're all of us in the gutter, but some of us are looking up at the stars." Now, what kind of religious organisation puts a statement like that on their notice boards? From dear Oscar Wilde, you perhaps know, who knew about life's both horrible and wonderful possibilities. Maybe I should have been brave and gone to talk with them one Sunday at Unity Chapel. My Unitarian journey might have started 10 years earlier than it actually did. And then when I finally discovered Unitarianism, what was it that appealed to me? And maybe as I'm talking, you'll think about what's appealed to you. I always start with this one, that I was not just allowed, but even encouraged to express doubt as well as faith. That really is so significant for me. It matters to me that there was no one single required system of belief. I wanted to hear about respect for all faiths and also respect for no faith, the conscious choosing of a humanist path. I needed a religion that was willing to engage with difficult religious and social issues. And the fact that the chapel seemed less hierarchical than many religious organisations. I like that lay people lead worship and perform exactly the same ceremonies and rituals as ministers. There's a levelling of hierarchies there. And best of all, I love exploring matters of faith in small groups. And so I'm here to shout out my joy that we Unitarians run small groups, these days both online and in person. So I've mentioned one of the early courses that I enjoyed back in the day, BYOT, Building Your Own Theology, but there are many others over the years. If you can get your hands on a copy of one called Life Tapestry or one called On the Path, and there is somewhere one copy that I have lost of a Bible study for Unitarians that is top-notch stuff. I'm looking for my copy of it. All really intriguing and helpful. Those courses were originally written for Unitarian Universalist congregations in the States, and they've been superseded now by our homegrown activities. Michael Illurid and Kate Dean's Soul Deep, Jane Blackall's Heart and Soul Gatherings, for example. These up-to-date materials, they're generously available to all of us, along with helpful guidance on how to run the courses, and I really highly recommend both of them. And why don't we all share the courses that we create? Because I know people are running small group activities in congregations all around the country. And I think one of my wishes as a result of this year's summer school is that some of us could lead or co-lead or encourage someone else to lead a new small group in your congregation or friendship group, in person or online. It's these Unitarian small groups, engagement groups as they're sometimes called, and they do get us to engage. They are actually still quite unusual in a faith setting. We're making space to speak and to listen about our faith, about our yearnings, about our doubts and our fears. We're making space for anything and everything to be spoken. It's a bit like we're doing in the groups each morning at summer school, isn't it? I think these kinds of groups demonstrate something about us humans, that sometimes our thoughts need to be spoken out loud and be listened to by others. Spoken into being, I've heard that called. That something special occurs through our interactions in groups that can help us to move our inner processes forwards. And that's why I'm committed to religious exploration, not just on my own, but in groups. Now I have Michael Mead, the Jungian speaker and writer, to thank for telling me that the Arabic word for belief derives from a root that can mean to tie together, to knot, or it can mean more gently to join together, to make an agreement. I'm quoting him here. There is a subtle difference found at the roots of belief, where one stem can tie a person in knots and overly restrict their innate imagination, obscuring their original way of being. The more tender and open-hearted side of belief can inspire a genuine sense of being woven into this world and secretly connected to the underlying union of life. He does write well, that Michael Mead. Yeah. And doesn't that resonate with our Unitarian emphasis on the oneness of all existence? We explore our beliefs deeply. We hold them dearly, but we generally don't ram them down each other's throats or hit one another about the head with one of Sheena's beautifully illustrated homegrown Bibles. We don't do that. Drawing on many, many sources. Back in the 1990s, in our Building Your Own Theology course, we created our own personal credos. We put our beliefs about various issues into writing. And then I found mine again decades later. And it was fascinating to see how some of my beliefs had certainly changed and grown. And then some had stayed pretty much the same. And I suspect you will have a similar feeling about yours. And in a course here at summer school, I can't remember now, I'm sure it did involve you, Sheena, we created our own spiritual toolbox. And it was an internal resource, as I seem to recall. But then from assorted summer school engagement groups, I have an actual box now, which I wanted it to come out and be on display. An actual box of spiritual tools that can be a kind of altar on the move. And the hands that are holding our chalice flame today. The funny thing is, I've made a big thing about these hands. I told Winnie that I was bringing them. But actually, in my memory, in the box, was a really quite big pair of hands. There's somebody came, and then when I unpacked the box, I had the tiny hands. These are the hands on the move. It's one of my practices when I'm worried about individual people or situations in our world, and that's quite often for the likes of me, is to light a candle and place it symbolically in these hands, or the bigger version. They're human hands, these, and yet they represent a higher power for me. I don't personally believe in divinity in human form, nor in a God that intervenes and responds to prayer. Yet these are hands of care and comfort. These are hands that symbolize my own powerlessness in the face of many, many life's issues. As a bit of an obsessive carer and problem solver, I need a process where I let go and let God, where I place responsibility towards a power greater than mine. So all these years of being encouraged to articulate my own religious beliefs, I can perhaps sum it up by stating that for me there is a great mystery about life itself. That's an understatement really, isn't it? Which I won't ever be able to fully comprehend. But it helps me to view life as both a gift and a curriculum, a training ground where I get to learn and develop, a place to mend and heal as best we can. I'd add that having an active relationship with the world of nature, of which we're inextricably part, seems now to be a most healing and vital thing in these times of environmental crisis. I believe that each of us possesses a unique spark of light and love within us that expands when it's encouraged and amplified and honoured. That Quaker teaching that there is that of God in everyone, and I'd add that of good in everyone, I recognise that we all have potential for both good and evil within us. That Sufi teaching, this too is me. That encourages me to go beyond dualistic thinking of us and them. And recently I've been introduced to the Roman playwright Terence's line stating that I am human and nothing human is alien to me. Surely a helpful reminder of our connectedness as one human race. So an idea I find especially helpful is to regard everyone I encounter, especially those I find difficult, as a potential teacher. This kind of practice is surely going to be helpful in these 21st century times when this emphasis on them and us seems to grow ever stronger, doesn't it? So let's pay attention to our dislikes and our reactivities. Let's lean into, if that idea works to you, lean into rather than backing away. Lean into, move towards that which we find challenging, repellent even. Remembering, of course, always to keep ourselves safe. Sometimes that leaning into just needs to be done in our own minds, using those old teachings of this too is me and Terence's line of I'm human and nothing human is alien to me. I've lost the plot, Winnie, in terms of I ought to crack on, oughtn't I? I won't do that meditation. I'll just get on. But just wriggle in your seats now. The meditation was going to be when you get into that thing of, I don't like this person, or I'm frightened of this person, or any of that kind of thinking, or why are they such prats? They are a prat, just like me. Yeah. They're frightening, just like me. They're pillocks, just like me. They're selfish, just like me. And on and on and on. There's nothing new, I suspect, under the sun when it comes to human experiences. And yet, look at us, we are ever creative, ever inventive. Look how technology has altered in a few years how we're doing church. We're just at the beginning of that particular exploration. We're honouring the old, we're being open to the new, making the way for that which is yet to come, honing our skills of welcome for those who are yet to appear. We Unitarians and Free Christians, we're still changing the song words, creating our own ceremonies and liturgies, having opinions, educating one another. So let's keep up the good work, everyone. All of us, and all of those people who are waiting to find us, we have the human capacity to experience awe and wonder, to be intrigued by life's mysteries, in the gutter, looking up at the stars. So let's be the communities that offer people opportunities to explore good company with one another, a small but vital gift we can offer our complex, beautiful, and at times quite scary 21st century world. Over to Winnie.
In part one, I spoke about what being Unitarian in the 21st century means to me, living out our values and meeting the needs that arise. We also explored how those values intersect with our theology. In this section, I want to explore how we might meet the moment to provide the religious community needed today and help build a better world for future generations. Stephen Ligwood, in his book Seeking Paradise, notes that our Unitarian tradition have centred around sets of stories, practices, attitudes, virtues, cultures and writings that uphold freedoms. And we've heard many stories in this summer school today week of people's Unitarian journeys. Our biggest story is how we came to be where we are today. Our living theology has always been tied to action, freedom from oppression and structural injustices. Historically, we fought to liberate ourselves from the state church, restrictive worship structures, Eucharistic beliefs, rigged prayers, and marginalisation in positions of power. Over time, this commitment to freedom expanded the rights to vote, women's liberation, LGBTQ rights, racial equality. We are a community rooted in autonomy, self-determination, and freedom for all. Articulating who we are has always been challenging. There's no single easy definition. But to answer the question from John, we are truly too autonomous, in my opinion, and less independence would be great. We mostly agree our values. We just have a million ways to enact them. Today, our call is to be relevant, to define the moment we are in and respond boldly. So I'm asking you to think about what issues and trends shape our world today. What issues and trends shape our world today? Shout them out.
Capitalism.
What else?
Division.
Isolation.
Isolation.
Genocide.
Liberation. Sorry?
Migration,
sorry.
Wars.
Power grabbing, wars, sense of entitlement,
fear,
exploitation of the earth, yes, all of that and so much more, disinformation, denial of the sacredness of life, widening economic inequality, I could go on and on, you know, our phobias, our isms. And to be honest, all of those are scary and daunting and overwhelming. And we barely know where to start with fixing these concerns. And what is worse, none of these concerns are new. Nothing is new under the sun. Maybe what is new for us is the ability to see all of this on a global scale at once with our technology advancement. But it's still overwhelming and numbing. Our theological mission, described in our constitution as the service of humanity and respect for all creation, calls us to respond to this moment with urgency. We can't do everything, but our faith compels us to do something grounded in the inherent worth and dignity of every person and the belief that none of us is free until all of us are free, expressed by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So in the past 3 years, I've visited the United States quite a number of times and I've engaged with our Unitarian Universalist colleagues to see how they are embodying our Unitarian faith and responding to the 21st century. They are striving to be a radically welcoming, counter-oppressive, pluralistic faith witness movement. So radically welcoming, counter-oppression, pluralistic faith witnessing movement. And by radically welcoming, I'm going to quote professor and author Kenneth P. Langer, who writes, "Inclusion is the process of asking people to become part of the community. But radical inclusion is the process of asking people to redefine the community through their presence and interaction." In other words, inclusion only assimilates new people into long-standing patterns, ensuring that nothing will be changed and the current system will not evolve. That's okay, if that's all you want to do. But if we don't change, we die, right? Radical inclusion transforms. It helps to shape, because you're asking people to shape the process with you and create change with you. Thereby, it's responding to the present needs of society. And that's what they're doing. And that's what I think we should be doing. One is the very much melting pot model. The other is the mosaic model. We need to be the mosaic model. And how are they doing this? They're examining their systems of oppression, their white supremacy culture and their structures. They're examining marginalizations, wages disparity, the denial of autonomy, access to Medicare or bodily autonomy and education. They're examining everyday barriers to inclusion, including children's Sunday sports activities. That means that children are not coming to church anymore. Post-pandemic fear is still very big. Neurodivergent accessibility, building accessibility, and they're responding by evolving new policies, new practices, new principles, new rituals, new activities, new services, songs, new everything. They're not throwing out the baby with the water, but they're bringing in new things too. And they elevate their voice to be a creative faith witness platform, acknowledging the people's lands their churches are built on, the acts of history that deny agency to different people, intentionally engaging in vigils and marches and solidarity statements. Statements on Palestine, Gaza, statements on the treatment of immigration by ISIS, statements on El Salvador and on the Florida alligator Alcatraz camp. They do it as a denomination. They lead, and then the churches follow with them. Well, we in the UK are in a less political conflict-ridden situation. There are still injustices and marginalisation and dehumanisation happening here. And the challenge for us is to be counter-cultural, counter-oppressive too. So, I'm aware of time. And I want to say one other important thing that we can do for the 21st century. We also need to take seriously building multi-generational and multi-platform worship and community engagements. Online spaces are not just tools to log into. They can be sacred spaces that intersect science, spirituality and community. Yes, we must be vigilant with AI. Andy was quite right about that. We must be vigilant. But think of gamers immersed in a virtual world for connection, not escape. That is what we must create. A beloved community in virtual spaces, spiritually fulfilling. Deepa Patel, a creative facilitator, who's working with the Petzl Institute in Amsterdam, is exploring such possibilities now. And I know it's scary to think about virtual spaces and not our buildings, but we need to follow what's going on in the 21st century and not fall behind. So friends, I want to conclude by saying our religion changes lives, as all the speakers this week has testified to. It plants seeds, as Mel said, reminding us that what religious life can be. Being Unitarian today is about deep connection. It's about a relationship with living courageously, imagining new possibilities and creating space for freedom and hope and radical inclusion for generations to come. To explore, to wrestle, to examine their beliefs and their non-beliefs, a place where the encounter can happen. So let us be about this holy work of making radical Unitarianism thrive. So we're going to invite you now to think about your freedoms. What freedoms do you appreciate in your life? And using your post-it notes to write down just three freedoms which we'll add to our prayer. And while you're doing that, we're going to play the music by Sam Smith, To Be Free. And we'll collect it in.
Wings of freedom.
Which will lead into our closing words, and we'll have to sing our two extra pieces of singing another time. So let's just quiet and still ourselves for these few minutes as we consider our great good fortune to be people who can worship freely and practice our religious faith as our consciences dictate. We do not face imprisonment generally for our beliefs, because our freedoms were won for us by courageous souls who came before us and prepared the way. They risked their livelihoods and even their lives for freedoms we may at times take for granted. So let's cherish our freedoms, and as we express our gratitude, may we also take on the responsibilities that freedoms bring, that our freedoms might never be the source of oppression for others. And in our community gathering today, we are appreciating the freedom to be educated, to love one who will love me, to doubt and believe simultaneously, our freedom to dissent and to leave, a freedom to vote, to speak my mind, to express my emotions, a free access to green space, a freedom to live where I choose and be who I choose, a freedom from poverty, freedom to live my life without people continually saying, when are you going to get married and have kids? Freedom of association. A freedom to travel. Let us feel that gratitude in our hearts. Amen.
So we close our time together, and I give you a quote from Dennis McCarthy, who says, "A life of faith demands so much more of us than mere belief." So as we move from a time of words and into a time of engagement, may our religion hold us connected to each other. Our radical faith weave awe and wonder on the bountifulness of the web of life. May our values be proclaimed in all that we do. And may we hold love, love, love in the palms of our hands. Go in peace and hope for a better tomorrow for our whole world, and live well, friends. We will play the hymn of Love Divine, and as you leave to go to your coffee and tea. Let's begin.
Thank you, my friend.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yes.